welcome to Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Joyous conversations about what the afterlife evidence and modern science combine to tell us is true about our one reality. You have nothing to fear. You are eternal and you are perfectly loved. Knowing the truth changes everything. Now, here's Roberta.
I've been married for 43 years. I cannot even imagine the pain of losing a treasured husband, but our guest today has suffered that pain twice, and she has triumphed. Welcome to Seek Reality. I'm Roberta Grimes. Our guest today is Janice Heafy Durham. Janice is the retired publisher of the Sacramento Bee, a very serious professional woman. She lost her husband, Max, to cancer on May 8, 2004, and his death precipitated a series of amazing events. I wish I had known about these before I wrote The Fun of Staying in Touch. It also started Janice on a voyage to try to understand death, which I really, really admire. The result is her wonderful book, which is out just this year, The Hand on the Mirror. Welcome, Janice. I'm so glad you're here.
Well, thank you, Roberta. I'm happy to be here with you as well.
We have a lot to talk about. This should be a several-hour interview, but unfortunately, we've got less than 1 hour. But there are so many things I think it's important that people know about you, Janice. Just briefly, tell me your background and where were you, all of these things are concerned, at the point when Max died?
Yes, well, my background is that I spent 30 years in the newspaper business, which is, as you know, a very fact-based business, and I was in that business at the Los Angeles Times for about 20 years and then recruited from the Los Angeles Times to the Sacramento Bee in Sacramento, California. It's a paper owned by the McClatchy newspaper chain. And there I became the first publisher in the history of the company and was responsible for all aspects, the business and the news, everything that's there. And it was a fabulous 10 years. I really appreciated that opportunity. And I was very proud to have been there when we received two Pulitzers over that 10-year period.
Wow, good for you.
Yeah, it was wonderful. And I give credit to the journalists. It's just that I was able to create, hopefully, the kind of culture that permitted those Pulitzers to take place. So very proud of that. And then while I was there in 2004, I began in 1998. In 2004, my husband, Max Bessler, who was a political consultant in Sacramento, passed away from esophageal cancer. He was diagnosed in October of 2003 and then died on May 8th. 2004.
Wow.
And after that, a series of extraordinary events, which I outline in the book, began to occur. Supernatural, I would call them sort of otherworldly events, began to occur.
Now, you had some conventional things happen, like lights blinking, which is a very, very common thing, and I loved the number synchronicities. These are things, for some reason, because I guess we all have digital clocks, it's easy for the dead to manipulate our clocks and for our guides, actually, to manipulate our clocks. Most people know that. So numbers are common, but you have some amazing ones. The time of his death kept showing up.
Yes. Yes, and I had go ahead.
I was just going to say, that was sort of a lead-in. You had something that I had never heard of before. What happened? Tell us what happened 1 year after his death.
Yes. What happened there was the first week after he died, it was exactly 1 week to the day of his death, I was taking a walk on the American River Parkway with my yellow lab, and it was around 7 a.m. When I came home, the large clock that was on the mantle above the fireplace in our living room, which is where Max had died the week before in the house, there was the clock. He had died at 12:44, and I looked up, it was around 7:30 in the morning, and instead of saying the proper time, it showed 12:44, which, it was a large, it was a traditional clock with clock hands. So it wasn't,
you're kidding,
digital.
It was a traditional clock, really?
Yes, a very large clock, and the hands of the clock were situated at 12:44. So I looked at that, and I woke my son Tanner up, who was 14 at the time, and said, Tanner, come, you have to come see this. So we looked and we knew the 1244 was an important number because when Max died, I'd written that down in a pad I was keeping, which I write everything down. my days at the newspaper, you know, it's just a habit. But I saw that I wrote that, yeah, when he had passed, I'd written that down for the officials, you know, that were going to come to take his body. So I knew the 1244 was the time. And there I looked at this clock and it was 1244, stopped.
It stopped at that time. That is very interesting. And that's remarkable, and I think people should just pause and appreciate that fact. It's easy for the dead to switch around a digital clock to make the numbers say anything they want them to say, and they do that. But changing a traditional clock requires them to move matter. And the fact that happened is... I'm kind of amazed at that. That's wonderful. That's a wonderful sign.
Yes, yes. And when it occurred, because I didn't have any experience with it or any framework, I basically chose to ignore it. I just said to myself, this has to be a battery.
That's weird.
Yeah, I just told myself it had to be. And there was behind the clock in a small case is the actual battery. But the thing is, neither my son nor myself would have been able to reach that clock. It was too heavy to pull down. So that's why no one could have stopped it. I mean, it occurred in the morning while I was on my walk and while Tanner was, while Tanner was in his, in his bed. So there's just no way.
That's really neat. I love that. Now, when did you see the hand?
1 year later, I saw the hand, and the hand appeared on the bathroom mirror. What was going on with that is that it was the actual anniversary of Max's death, so it was May 8, 2005. It was a Sunday, happened to be Mother's Day. My son and I were in the backyard in Sacramento just having a lovely Sunday time together. A little bit sad for the anniversary, of course, but just being together was nice. And I decided to go in the house to make us a sandwich and a snack. And there was near to the kitchen what I would call our guest suite area. And that's where Max had spent the end of his life, was in that bedroom the very last five weeks before he passed, because he was more comfortable sleeping separately just given his condition.
Oh,
and
sure.
He wanted me to get my sleep, you know, because I was going to work. Anyway, I that's the area of the house that I went to wash my hands and just, you know, touch my hair up. And as I looked up at the mirror, turned on the water, I saw this handprint. It was perfectly formed. It was powdery. And it was large. It was the right hand. And the fingers were straight out. And what was most extraordinary about it was the perfection of the imprint. I mean, you could see every line as if it were an x-ray, every line within the powder. It was
really
extraordinary. And I just looked at it and said to Tanner, I called out to him like I had with the clock. I said, you have to come in here. And so when he came in, he was just like I was, shocked and stunned by what it was that we saw.
Wow. What gets me is that you were able later to remove it. I think I would have had it framed or something, take the glass out. I don't know what I would have done, but that's astonishing. Were you attempting to communicate with him through a medium or doing any of those things at this time?
No. I wasn't doing any of those things because I was really focused 100% on my work and raising my son and just trying to move forward, you know, through the grief. So I didn't think to take a sample. And there's another issue with that as well, which is that I never took a sample because, the prints came back twice. They came back again. It was a total of three, but they came back in 06 and 07. And the reason that I didn't take a sample is a valid reason, which is that as publisher of the newspaper, I could not put the paper under that kind of scrutiny. In other words,
you were still working. Okay. You were still working.
Yeah, I was working. Yeah. And there's no way. I mean, I would have had to have called the head of the sheriff's department and Lou Glanis and asked him, you know, for some forensic help. And once I did that, it would be public matter. And that is not something I could do at the paper. So I never did that.
Well, that's understandable. And you were moving on. Tanner was 14 or 15 at the time?
Yes, Tanner was in school, and, you know, I was, you know, trying to keep my life together with the newspaper, and I wanted that structure and needed that structure. So I basically made a decision to not investigate anything until I retired. And once I had retired, which was April of 2008, then I was in a position to start considering what this all could mean. And enough experiences had accumulated that to deny the reality, it would not be possible for me to deny the reality. I mean, part of critical thinking, as you know, critical thinking means that it's a good thing. You want to apply research and you want to apply any kind of investigative work to make sure you formulate the right thoughts. And so ultimately what I decided, and I was prompted by a very good friend of mine, she said, why don't you do what you did in the newspaper industry for 30 years, and that is research and investigate the question of, does our consciousness survive death? And that was a pivotal moment when she suggested, you know, you need to do that. And I went out and I said to myself, that is exactly what I want to do. And I wanted to look at it not just spiritually, but scientifically.
Yes,
I wanted to ask the question, you know, what happens with our energy when we pass on? And that was why I ended up interviewing a number of scientists and people who have spent their lives looking at this. I mean, one of the most interesting of those was Dr. Bruce Grayson, who's at the University of Virginia, and he has studied near-death experiences. And I think near-death experiences are one of the strongest pieces of evidence that we have, that there is more. So I asked myself that question, is there more? Does our consciousness survive death? And I began to interview these various scientists. One would lead me to another, and each time I would find and uncover something new. You'll see that when you read the book, of course.
Yes, this is a detective story. This is actually on many levels, many different kinds of stories. The fact that you did this research by going right to these people and sitting in their offices is really remarkable. But let's step back, because one of the things that Max said before he died was that you would find love again. You said, no way. But it happened, right? Tell us about Jim.
Well, Jim was someone that I ran into through some friends. I knew him in the Sacramento community, but he was married previously to someone else, obviously. Anyway, I knew of him, but I met him as I learned he was going through a divorce. I met up with him again, and I think what happened there is I really did not believe that I would find love again, the kind that I had with Max, which was so profound and so full and so driven by chemistry, you know, where you didn't have to ever try. And Jim was a very unusual man. He's extremely smart and very solid. His character is without dispute the finest, high values, and a wonderful father, a very good person, and also a Renaissance man similar to Max, in that he was interested in everything, opera, literature, current events, poetry. I mean, he was interested in all these things, and he was an avid outdoorsman. He was a fisherman, and he was a hunter, and a skier, and a sailor, and a hiker. And so I fell madly in love with him in 2006.
But watching it happen in the book made the reader feel that he was helping you become whole again. He was drawing you out of what was tremendous grief and sort of helping to open you. So you got the suggestion that perhaps you should do this research from a friend, but I sort of saw the fact that he was willing to encourage you in it and go on some of these trips as part of the reason you did it. He was there for you.
Exactly, Roberta, you said it beautifully, and I like thinking of it that way, actually. He absolutely was a proponent, an advocate, a supporter. He was intrigued. You know, he's an engineer by education, an accountant, and a CPA, and he had a tremendous imagination and curiosity and a sense of wonderment about nature and life. And I think that Yes, he wanted me to do this. He was my biggest fan in terms of, when I say fan, it sounds like a silly word. I suppose I mean
component. No, I know what you mean, though. He really was. That's exactly right. That's right. What a wonderful man that he was able to sort of be part of your life. He could encourage you to do what, to someone like him who had no background, and this was kind of woo-woo, actually.
Yes, in fact, he would call it that in the beginning. He said he wasn't sure if it was maybe woo-woo, but then he experienced the moving rugs with me, and he experienced the flickering of lights and then the footprint that came to our home in Sun Valley. So the things that he witnessed, I think that was part of what happened. It's by witnessing and experiencing those things, he became a true believer that there actually is another realm, for certain, another reality that coexists with ours.
Now, Dr. Paul Wendland, whom I had never heard of, I have to know more about this man. But one of the first people you went to was an experimental physicist who...
Yes.
What amazed me about this, Janice, is that his view of how it all works is essentially exactly the same view that I developed, coming from a wholly different direction and never even having taken physics in high school. I've spent decades researching communications from the dead, which are amazing. And I think that if you looked at them, you would feel about them as you feel about near-death experiences. It had told us all that. And then the couple of Quantum Physics for Dummies books filled it in. He came to exactly the same conclusions, and he had never heard from the dead, which was really, really striking. I loved hearing what he had to say. Tell us a little bit about Dr. Wendland and his views of consciousness.
Well, it's very interesting. He believes in quantum physics, and as you probably know, quantum physics is sometimes called quantum mechanics, but it's a branch of physics that deals with behavior at what we call the subatomic level. And if you think about traditional physics, which was largely founded by Sir Isaac Newton, it brought us a long way over 350 years, but as we went into our new century, into the 1900s, it became clear that at the subatomic level, this traditional physics just wasn't matching what was happening experientially. And that's what Dr. Wendland helped me see. He says that it's crucial for theory to have experimentation because it predicts results confirmed by the experiment. So basically, you know, these people came out, they came out, these new quantum physicists, with what was even defined by Einstein as a spooky, he called it spooky, the implications of the theory. And so even though I don't pretend to be a scientist by any means, but I think that there was enough that I learned from him that the mind can actually, and this is one of the precepts inside of quantum physics, is that it predicts things. So, for example, it predicts that the mind can influence behavior of energy and matter. And for me, what that said was that Max's consciousness could have been influencing what I saw. So, in other words, his mind could have made the prints appear on the mirror. And then then because I paid attention and because my mind was also assigned similarly, I actually saw it. And then the second thing that quantum physics says is that an energy particle, such as light, is actually very interestingly located in multiple locations.
Yeah.
So it isn't until we actually see the particle and observe it that the location's determined. So that made me think, well, gee, if it hadn't been me looking at that mirror, would it have been, and I hadn't observed it, did it exist? And I know some of this sounds a little esoteric, but I think what it's basically pointing me to believe and what Dr. Wendland helped me to understand is that there, you can take quantum physics and you can apply the theories in quantum physics to what was happening, and you can make a rational explanation that it could occur.
Yes, yes. This whole notion that consciousness, human consciousness, is what makes matter even exist is one that actually Max Planck, who got the 1918 Nobel Prize for being the father of quantum mechanics, he said this stuff, and he was saying it in the first part of the 20th century, and he was altogether ignored. Many quantum physicists scratching their heads. Einstein didn't like this. Some of them have liked it better. Many quantum physicists have privately come to these conclusions. But Dr. Wendland, you hit a star there, because and if for no other reason, I urge people to read your book, because what the scientists that you consulted told you is so remarkable and amazing and consistent with what those of us who have not been scientists and have used just objective research to come to this conclusion. Everyone will come to the same place, Janice. It's so amazing. It is all real. It's real.
Exactly. And this guy, I mean, Dr. Wendland taught at UCLA as a PhD from there, and he was a professor, and he had some major companies that he also started. He worked on the Voyager, the sensor light for the Voyager spacecraft. And so he was a very intelligent and determined scientist. And so he's extremely credible. And for him to take the leap to say, well, what does this mean? You know, if our consciousness actually is there first and it's what forms matter, it's kind of the antithesis of saying matter exists and then we observe it. So I think it's a very, as a category of interest, the quantum physics is fascinating. And I think I would encourage your listeners to go out and study whatever it is they can find out about quantum physics.
So with Dr. Wendland, you came to understand human consciousness was kind of making it happen. And I loved that he quoted that old limerick. I can't quote it, but it's in your book, when basically the tree is there thanks to yours faithfully, God. That's an old limerick about the fact that they figured out that quantum physics shows that human consciousness is what makes it happen. But the next step then is to discover that there's really only one consciousness of it. And as I recall, you went to Dr. Radin. Dean Radin, in case there is anyone on Earth who doesn't know who he is with the Institute of it's IONS, Institute of Duetic Sciences, that's what it is, in California. And he is just a dean in this field. He's done so much wonderful, productive research on consciousness and how it actually works. Tell us a little about what Dr. Radin taught you.
Well, Dr. Radin pioneered in the field of what's called meta-analysis at Princeton University, and he was doing that work in the 1980s, the late 1980s. And basically what meta-analysis is a technique in statistics where you take, you know, you combine the results of similar, but they're definitely separate studies, and you make conclusions when you combine them. So, for example, at Princeton, Dr. Radin combined the results of over 800 separate experiments. And he came up with a startling result that experientially the odds that the human mind was affecting outcomes was over 1 trillion to 1.
A trillion is a large number.
It's a large number, and it's so interesting, because then I think what it tells you is that there's a likelihood of telepathy, and that the mind can actually, you know, affect matter. This gets back to this whole thing about what is consciousness, and if it's that powerful, and if it's that strong, why would it die? I mean, because there are many scientists who believe in the classic form of science, which is that when your mind dies, you know, it stops. Everything stops. The brain stops, the heart, the lungs, and you're gone.
Yes.
And you're claimed legally, and I shouldn't say legally, you're claimed scientifically dead at that time. The suggestion from the research that Dr. Radin's done is that that's not true. The mind continues in another form. The consciousness exists beyond the body. In fact, it's outside of the body. And many of people that I talked with ended up teaching me that the brain is more like just a receptor. You know, it's kind of like, like a television station or a radio station where it's not the original programmer. It's just something that's come, you know, it's like a filter. So it doesn't make original programming. That's why I think this whole notion of a universal consciousness, of a consciousness that we can tap into if we pay more attention. And that's one thing that each one of the scientists I interviewed if there was one common theme, it was to pay attention, that the things that you ordinarily might dismiss as synchronicity or as a coincidence, if you listen and pay more attention and live in the present and observe those things and start living your life at a higher level of appreciation, I think you'll begin to see more of these things happen.
Yes. Yes, exactly right. What we've come to the conclusion must be the case, those of us doing afterlife research, is that not only is human consciousness primary and pre-existing, but it's also one. There's one human consciousness, and we are all part of it. Inextricably, it's not as if we're separate atoms of God, if you will, but we're all inextricably part of that. And yet we have separate awareness, and that awareness, as far as we're able to determine, never ends. We've been in communication with people at very high levels of what we think of as the afterlife, which is really the main reality that we are not, that we're part of, but we don't know that yet. And even at the very highest levels, they remain separate. Aware. So if anyone is worried that hearing that we're all one consciousness means that you're going to be extinguished, no, apparently that never happens. We are always uniquely ourselves, but we are also part of everybody else, everybody on the street, everybody you've ever loved, and what we think of as God. Although at this point, Janice, I'm not using the word as much because the religions have given God a very bad name. God is only love. There is no other emotion that is anywhere near the actual reality that is mind, that is all that exists. But it's, as you began, I could watch you opening out to these facts as I watched you do your research, obviously having made notes along the way so you knew how you were feeling at each time. But wasn't it like a gradual opening to more and more possibilities? That's how it sounded.
Yes, I think so. And I think that's why it's so important in life to be open and to be open to discovery. If you think of any invention, any technology, any piece of art, any piece of literature, any great poem, it didn't exist until someone thought of it. And the way that
right.
they thought of it is they were open. But I think the mind sometimes works against us in that you can become closed, and you want to, it's called self-affirmation, I believe, where you say, okay, I'm only going to believe what I believe that I've been taught, or that you know,
yes.
the society, whether it's an institution of school or church or family or business or government, you know, one of the staple institutions in our society that keeps us organized, which makes sense. But one of those institutions may have taught us to think a certain way, and so we get in the habit of thinking that way, and then we are not open to the idea of something else. In fact, on my book tour, I was in St. Charles, which is the beginning of the Lewis and Clark expedition out west, and I couldn't help but thinking, what if they hadn't had the courage to say what lies beyond St. Charles, and they began
right.
to map it out. Yeah, and so any kind of discovery, or Christopher Columbus, you know, I mean, there are so many examples of expeditions. And people said, I want to know what's beyond what we're supposed to believe is there. And so that's
right.
why this discovery and experimentation is so important in life, and that the essential ingredient is to remain open to say that it's possible. I mean, even Sam Harris, who is quite the atheist or agnostic, is open to the idea that there's more. And so I think it makes life far more fascinating to think that there is more in every way. And yes, I think each one of these scientists reinforced my belief that there is more and that we need to remain open.
Well, we have more of this to come, but I'm just going to pause here and say this is Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. My nonfiction books are The Fun of Dying, Find Out What Really Happens Next, and The Fun of Staying in Touch, which is about some of what we're going to be talking a bit more with Janice about, the kinds of signs that the dead give us that they are here and they're just fine. You can learn more about all my books and find my blog at robertagrimes.com. Now, our guest today is Janice Heapy Durham. She's a professional. She's always been fact-based. She was a publisher for 10 years of a major metropolitan newspaper. But her beloved husband died 10 years ago, and then strange things started to happen. as a researcher, which is what you clearly are, she had to figure out what was really going on. And the result is her wonderful book, which I urge everyone to read. It's called The Hand on the Mirror. And wow, does it contain signs? I've done a lot of research on signs because I bring a book on signs. She got signs I've never even heard of. So this was really an amazing. I know you weren't sure some of this came from Max, but I've got to say, Max is a virtuoso at signs. He has done some really clever things, and we'll talk about them actually now. Please tell us more of the things that Max, while you still were not sure it was really Max, the things he was doing for you.
Well, yes, I think that the three paramount images that I received on the anniversary of his death, so 2005, 2006, and 2007, these were the prints, the powdery prints. And the first year was the right hand print. The second year, actually, it was a number of small angels, perfectly formed, just like an angel you'd imagine on a Christmas tree with the little wings. That was the second anniversary, again, the powdery print. And then the third anniversary was the left hand, but the left hand had evolved considerably from the right hand of 2005. The left hand of 2007 was more dispensed, amorphous, just sort of dispelling energy, it looked like, almost from the fingertips, and you'll see in the book.
Wavy fingers. Yes, wavy fingers. There are pictures, yeah, by the way, in the book. There's good color pictures about all of this.
Remember, you can see,
these are appearing on a bathroom mirror, just the mirror that's off that's in the bathroom, off the bedroom where Max died in his home. These, on the anniversary, now this is not a coincidence, of his death for 3 years, these things happened. I have never heard of that, and I think it's really, really wonderful.
Yes, it was startling, and it was amazing. It was stunning and sometimes shocking to absorb, but it was definitely real, and thankfully I had the wherewithal to photograph it. You know, as time went on, we ended up also, Jim and myself, ended up observing two separate instances where we had rugs move. One was in our Sun Valley home that we were renting while we were building our home, and it was a rug that moved about 9 inches in the master bedroom. It was placed just below the end of the bed, you know, maybe a foot out from the end of the bed, between the bed and the fireplace. And one day my husband said, it was the summer, it was the June of 2008, right before we were getting married. He said, why do you keep moving the rug, honey? Why do you keep moving the rug? I said, well, I don't know what you mean. I haven't moved it. And he said, you haven't? And he is a very precise person who is, you know, he was a sailor, and so everything has its place. He said, no, it's moving. So we marked it with blue tape, not very scientific, and we watched as it moved over 24 hours, approximately 8 or 9 inches. Now, this was on top of another rug. So it was, think of it that way. It was an Asian or Oriental rug, and it was sitting on top of carpet, which makes it nearly impossible to move if you walked across
that wouldn't
you
move.
Couldn't,
right.
Yeah, you couldn't move it. And then a year later, we were in our home in Napa, the weekend home, and then we had this rug that moved in the kitchen, and it moved once again between 9 and 10.5 inches. And we ended up, because we'd had the other experience, we ended up this time with, we had a tape measure and a little card, and I documented it over two trials and some 48 hours each time. And it moved, and you'll see all this in the book, but it moved between 8.5 and, as I said, and 10.5 inches. And it sounds preposterous when you just hear about this. You think, how is this possible? But it's a physical manifestation that actually absolutely occurred. And it occurred in the kitchen, and it also occurred in the master bedroom. So there were two rugs in that house that moved. And then the other, I think, consequential event was we had gone for our anniversary. We were living in Sun Valley, Idaho. We'd gone up to the Middle Fork for an anniversary to a cabin that we have, and we came back down, and we came into the house, and there was in our den area a large gold club chair with a footprint right on the edge of the arm of the foot chair, and it was of the club chair, and it was a large footprint.
Bigger than a regular larger, footprint.
Larger than a human. And very much like the handprint in that you could see all the lines of the character of the actual print of the foot. And it changed. That was what was different from the handprints on the mirror. This print actually changed over 48 hours. It shifted, and then it began to have something like a slight line extension come from the top of the foot. All of that's in the book as well, but it was extraordinary. And that
the thing that's interesting about Max to me is that he is able to manipulate matter more aggressively than just about any dead person I've heard of. I mean, the notion of stopping a mechanical clock, also putting this powder, which I hope you're going to eventually have analyzed at some point, onto the mirror, this making prints appear, this making rugs move, this is unusual, Janice. Very few of the dead give that kind of sign. The blinking lights, which you've also had, that's a much more common sign. Or turning on and off televisions. For some reason, they like to do that. But that was really remarkable. All they can do with matter is create, they don't create, they make pennies appear or dimes appear as apports. Usually they dematerialize them somewhere and they make them materialize where you didn't expect to find a coin. And that they can do. But Max is a virtuoso and he's very powerful that he can do that with matter. It's quite amazing.
Yes, I think so too. I think that was really in part why I also wanted to write the book, because I felt as if indeed he had succeeded in who knows how hard that was to accomplish from the other side.
It must have been hard, yes.
It must have been very difficult, and so there was no way that I could turn my back on him, and that was part of what provoked my and urged me to write the book, was that I wanted to be able to respond to him at the same level, you know, that he had tried to reach me. I wanted to make sure I closed that loop. And the other reason, too, that I wanted to write this book is because I wanted to create a legitimate foundation for dialogue. I think that many people have had after-death communications and have experienced with the loss of a loved one, unusual experiences.
Yes.
They've had them in their life, and yet they're reluctant to talk about them. And there was a woman I had met actually at the symphony here in Idaho, the Sun Valley Summer Symphony, who told me an experience she had where when she was diagnosed with cancer, she had breast cancer 9 years earlier, she was diagnosed in the doctor's office. She said that she literally left her body and she was on the ceiling looking down at the top of the doctor's head and her husband's head, and she could see every detail, and she knew she was out of her body. She went back into her body, and when she absorbed the discussion, she went back into her body. Now, she was told she was not going to make it, but she did make it. And 9 years later, she's telling me the story, and she started to cry, and she said, you know, I never told my husband. She was afraid of what he would think.
Yes.
That she had left her body. And that was a very important moment for me, because I realized that people are so inhibited to be seen as ordinary. You know, we all want to be believed to be in line. And so
That's right.
Why we don't speak out. And I think then I thought, you know, I've got to figure out a way to talk about this, because if I write this book, then maybe people will read it. And if they read it, then they might discuss it with a friend and they might begin to have this dialogue. So I'm happy about the fact that it was published, because it affords a mainstream dialogue to take place, you know, not just here, not just in America, but in other parts of the world as well.
Just tell us about the Max Bridge. You went and your parents had died. You went and buried them, and you didn't think Max was there or giving you any signs. So lo and behold, in a place where you would never have imagined that bridge would be, you see a new bridge, and it's called
the Max Bridge.
The Max Bridge. Okay, so I just want people to appreciate what a virtuoso Max is. First, he makes you see the Max Bridge. And then, for some reason, you're going a different way out of the city, and you take a different road. What did you see on that road?
It was amazing, Roberta. And also what's important about it is that this is a very small town. I think we're talking 1,100 people, or maybe it's less now. I don't have the statistic in front of me, but it's a tiny town in it's in Nebraska, where my mother was born and raised, and where we decided, because to honor their wishes, we buried them in the cemetery there in Cambridge. So our family all flew in to be a part of that service, to have the memorial. And when it was completed, I took that walk after my family said goodbye, and Jim and I were packing up with our yellow lab. And I said, you know, I'm going to take this walk. And I went to the park, and I saw this beautiful small river, and then I saw this bridge, and I went closer to read the plaque, and I couldn't believe it. I was stunned. It said the Max Bridge, which basically, you know, reminded me of a woman that I had worked with, a spiritual woman, who said, you know, she thought of it as the bridge between this world and the next. So it was quite a metaphor. I mean, it's literally a bridge called the Max Bridge to the other side across the water. And then we got in the car and we decided to say goodbye to one of my mother's old friends. She's 95 or 7, and we stopped at the assisted living facility on the way out of town. And there was only one way in and one way out. Two ways in and two ways out. And this was the other end of it. So we hadn't been there yet. We were leaving. And as we left, I looked up. There was a giant sign that said Bessler Industries, B-E-S-L-E-R. Yeah, right.
What was Max's last name?
Bessler.
Wonderful? What a great... So he's saying, you don't think I'm here, right? Well, let me just do something fancy. He's not doing anything boring. What he's doing is first making you see that somehow he made a bridge happen there with his first name on it, and then he made a company, set up a whole industry, and then had you drive by it, and it was his last name. So I just love this guy. I think he's doing a wonderful job in keeping himself active in your life, and he's, I'm sure, got a big grin as he does it.
Yes. And he had a great sense of humor, so he probably would have a grin on. That's true.
Yes. Yeah, but creative. What a creative man. But now you've had tragedy happen to you again. Tell us what happened to Jim.
My husband, Jim Durham, passed away on May 11th, just 8 weeks ago, in Tiburon, California, where we were living. And sadly, he had been fighting head and neck cancer for 2 years. And we had received a lot of therapy, radiation and chemotherapy at Moffitt Cancer Center in Florida, and also at MD Anderson, and then ultimately UCSF. So Jim fought that battle with great courage and stamina and a ferocious sense of wanting to stay alive. And it was very tragic that in the end he lost that battle. Yes.
I'm very sorry. Have you heard from him yet, or is he still adjusting?
I have heard some things, but I'm not prepared to talk about that right now. I'm still absorbing it. But yes, some things have occurred.
I'm glad.
Yes, and so I will be, after I work on this a little bit, my own grief and own sense of loss, then I'll be in a position where I can talk about that, but at present I'm really not.
I'm glad you've heard from him. I mean, you know he's fine. We now know that our loved ones are all fine, but still, we want them to reach out and touch our hand, somehow help us know that they're okay. So I'm so glad he's done that for you.
Yes.
So what's next for you? Are you continuing to work in this field? What are you doing now?
Well, I'm trying to listen very closely to what it is I should be doing. And I think there's something more that I would like to do. I am... finished a 12-city tour, book tour, not too long ago. And also, I'm continuing to do interviews and so on and speak where possible about the book. But I'm thinking of a potential second book, and I'm not sure exactly what until it reveals itself. But I
know,
believe,
the feeling.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. And I believe it's, a gift, so I want to be able to give that gift. And I'm totally open to it. But again, I'm concentrating now on the unexpected death of Jim. We knew that he was terminal, but we thought he had more like 6 months left, and that, you know, sure, we would get through the remainder of this year. So I'm absorbing a very deep and serious and consequential loss right now. So I'm involved in that, and yeah, more than I am anything probably.
It's important to grieve, and it's important to acknowledge people's grief. I think one of the things that I've noticed about people who know the truth is that sometimes they'll say, God, you know, it's fine, go on with life. Well, it's very hard to lose a presence like that out of your life, and to have had two husbands that you adored go on ahead of you is not easy, just as it's not easy if you lose a child. So I understand and respect that this is a process you've got to go through. 2 months is not long. But you're clearly a strong and determined person, and you're trying even now to help people to make their own connections with what's happening to them. One of the things that Janice would like is, if you have stories like this or any kind of story of the way what we used to call supernatural events have touched, she'd like to hear about them. Just go to The Hand on the Mirror, all is one word, thehandonthemirror.org, and share your stories. It's a place to talk about the things that maybe you haven't wanted to talk with others about. Because one of the things that comes out of Janice's book most strongly is her realization that it's very hard. And I've shared this with her as well. I'm an attorney. I didn't want to come out with any of the stuff I've had to come out with over the last few years, but you at some point you can't be silent anymore. You've got to talk about what's true. And so Janice would like, I think, to help all of us be more forthcoming about our truth, so that we are people know around everyone around you. Look around you. Everybody you know has had at least one extraordinary experience, certainly by midlife. I had my first at 8 years old. I never told anybody about it till I was in my 40s. It's time for all of us to be welcoming receptacles for people who have information to share, which is precious. There is no such thing as a supernatural experience. There only are experiences we don't yet understand. And we help everybody when we listen and accept and validate what happens in people's lives. I'm so sorry we've come to the end of our time, Janice, but I hope that we can do this again.
Well, thank you very much, Roberta, and thank you for encouraging people to come forward. And I do hope that if you have a story, any of your listeners have a story, that they will go to thehandonthemirror.org and tell that story. There is a mechanism. We have an application on the website. So I encourage people to come forward. And we have a newsletter we're publishing called Illumination, which is going to be a series of those letters we receive. We're going to make them available to others. So thank you very much, Roberta, for having me on your program. And I'm delighted to be a part of it, and I want to do everything I can to help you and to help this dialogue to go forward.
Boy, consider yourself hugged. I think we're already friends. This has been Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. You are a powerful, eternal being. You never began. You never will end. And when you fully grasp all the implications of that fact, it's going to change everything in your life for the better. If you'd like to learn more of the amazing things we're learning about our one reality, past episodes of Seek Reality are available for free on iTunes. Just search there for Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. And as I always say, my nonfiction books are The Fun of Dying, Find Out What Really Happens Next, and The Fun of Staying in Touch, which is about signs from the dead. And I wish I had had Max as my expert consultant, frankly. There are many wonderful ways the dead are reaching out to us, and the more we share what those are, the more other people are going to recognize them in their own lives. Again, you can find everything about all my books at robertagrimes.com. Next week, we're going to be talking with Christine Morgan. Is a brilliant, very gifted Australian medium, but she's even more than that, an expert on mediumship. And this is an area where I have very little information, and I'm going to be learning with the rest of you. So I look forward to talking with Christine all the way from Australia. This week, we've been speaking with the wonderful Janice Yeesey Durham. She's the retired publisher of the Sacramento Bee. She lost her husband, Max, in 2004, and she has lost her second husband. We know they're not lost at all. There's just a little separation, and it's amazingly small. They're all right here with us now. But still, it's hard not to have it's hard not to have these people who are so important to us where we can touch them. I'm hoping that Janice is going to write about what I'm sure are amazing things that Jim is doing for her now, but that's something which we'll look forward to in the future. Meanwhile, I urge everyone to think about the fact that this is someone who is absolutely facts-based, still is actually facts-based and based on what we think of as everything that's sort of material around us. Nothing could be further from the truth, though. And when, to her great credit, when Janice began to have these experiences, she pursued them. What I urge everybody to do is to take that journey now. Pursue, when you have something unusual in your life, pursue it. Try to understand what's going on. There are excellent books, excellent experts available. You don't everyone doesn't have to go and try to meet Dean Radin and Gary Schwartz and all of the experts who are working in this field. They've all written books, and their books, Dean Radin's are fabulous, and Gary Schwartz, everything he touches is gold. So I urge you now to please give the truth a chance to begin to dawn in your own life. Knowing the truth about what really is going on turns what it is right now, a tragedy, life sucks then you die, is basically the way many people live. It turns all of that into the most joyous comedy you could imagine. There is no happiness greater than fully understanding that you, everybody you love, truly, we all are eternal. So please give yourself that gift. But for now, please enjoy and make the most coming week in our reality, knowing that you are a powerful, eternal being and you are infinitely loved.